Welcome, everyone, to Inside the Case. I'm Kinsey Durbin, former host of your favorite true crime podcast, Crimeaholics. Join me as I venture into a new journey fighting for justice here on Inside the Case. This is where we will dive into the haunting stories of the missing and murdered that have shaken tight-knit communities to their core. On Inside the Case, together we will explore the tangled webs of suspicion, the red herrings, and the breakthroughs that bring hope to those that have been left behind. Together, we will journey into the heart of darkness, seeking answers, demanding justice, and shining light on the faces that have vanished but will never be forgotten. Lake County, Illinois is a picturesque region located just north of Chicago, known for its stunning natural landscapes and vibrant communities. The county features a diverse array of lakes, parks, and forest preserves, making it a haven for anybody who just loves the outdoors. The Channel Lakes is a very popular recreational area that offers opportunities for boating, fishing, and hiking, while the scenic Lake Michigan shoreline even provides a very beautiful beach. However, this beautiful community also holds one of the most tragic domestic violence stories that would eventually lead to the gruesome murder of a young girl named Kathleen Tarowski. In the serene town of Fox Lake within Lake County, Illinois, Kathleen Tarowski radiated joy and ambition. Growing up in a close, tight-knit family with her mother Betty, father Bob, older brother Ricky, and her younger brother Brad, she was the light of their lives. Kathleen had a very infectious smile and a love for 80s music, often blasting her favorite songs as she danced around the living room. Christmas was her favorite time of the year, filled with traditions, decorations, and the warmth of family gatherings. Brad, her younger brother, looked up to her immensely, often declaring, "Kathleen is the sister every younger brother dreamed of having." Her intelligence and determination showed as she graduated with honors from the College of Lake County, earning an associate's degree on a scholarship. With aspirations to become a physical therapist, Kathleen was well on her way to a bright future. At just 21, Kathleen was working at Condell Medical Center in Libertyville, where her kindness and dedication impressed colleagues and patients alike. Her supervisors saw a lot of potential in her, and she already had a job lined up at the Easter Seal Society in Woodstock, Illinois. This is a nonprofit organization that provided essential services to people with several different types of disabilities. This role was a perfect fit for her compassionate nature, allowing her to make a tangible difference in the lives of others. With plans to further her education and gain a bachelor's degree, Kathleen seemed set to achieve great things, supported by her family and friends who all recognized her remarkable abilities. However, as the fall of 1989 approached, Kathleen began dating John Cumby, an older man who quickly became a significant part of her life. Friends and family were initially cautious, but they were supportive, hoping that Kathleen had found a kindred spirit as herself. As they spent more time together, though, a tough shift had occurred. Kathleen became more withdrawn, her laughter fading into the background as the shadows of doubt had crept in. Those close to her noticed the change, and the vibrant girl, who once lifted up every room, seemed to be becoming increasingly distant, caught in a web of complicated emotions that left her friends concerned for her well-being. Kathleen was drawn to John Cumby in a way that felt both exhilarating yet a little bit frightening. At 33, he had this magnetic charm that captivated her from the moment the two of them had met. A former cop turned volunteer firefighter, he carried himself with an air of authority that both reassured and fascinated Kathleen. The stories he told her of saving lives and serving the community deepened her admiration for him, making it easier for her to fall head over heels for him, and fast. Each moment they spent together felt electric, as if the world around them had faded away, leaving only the two of them in a blissful bubble. Kathleen couldn't help but envision a future filled with shared dreams, laughter, and adventure with John. But beneath the surface of this whirlwind romance between the two of them laid a complexity Kathleen was reluctant to confront. She soon learned about John's life, meaning he had a whole marriage and two young sons. Kathleen would often ask John about his marriage, but John was always very vague and provided very little detail. Despite the red flags, she found herself rationalizing all of his choices. He presented himself as a man seeking a second chance, and her heart swelled with compassion for the struggles that John had supposedly faced in his marriage. Kathleen wanted to believe that he was ready to embrace a new life with her. The affection that he showed her in the beginning felt very genuine, pulling her further into a relationship that seemed both promising and healthy. As the days turned into weeks, their connection deepened and she began to ignore all the nagging doubts that were in her mind. But before we get too far, let's talk about John for a minute. John Cumby's story begins in the quiet suburb of Ingleside, Illinois, where he lived with his wife, Connie, and their two young sons. To the outside world, John appeared to be a dedicated family man and a respected former police officer, eventually turned volunteer firefighter. However, lurking beneath this facade was a darkness that would ultimately lead to Kathleen's murder. My very own family moved to the city of Chicago, to the same small suburb, unknowingly becoming neighbors with John and Connie. My family quickly became entwined in John's web of abuse and violence that would haunt us all for life. My grandparents and aunts had settled just four houses away, eager to embrace their new life in the suburbs, but little did they know what lay behind the closed doors of the Cumby household. Upon my family's arrival, John and Connie came to introduce themselves. My grandmother said that she had always sensed something was off about John. Her woman's intuition screamed caution, yet she dismissed it, convincing herself that she was overthinking. This nagging feeling became a distant whisper as she and my family began to integrate into the community. Eventually, my oldest aunt became a babysitter for John and Connie. My grandmother was allowing her to witness firsthand the troubling dynamics of their home. However, my grandmother had no idea that this was happening. My aunt often noticed bruises on Connie, remnants of a life filled with silent suffering. But as a child, she didn't fully understand the implications. Now, as an adult, she says she often carries the heavy burden of wishing that she had spoken up sooner. The whispers of abuse didn't stop at physical marks. The sounds of screaming and objects being thrown echoed through the neighborhood. My aunt would often recount how she and the neighborhood kids played outside, often being interrupted by John's explosive outbursts directed towards Connie. It painted a chilling picture of a household that was ruled by nothing but fear. As the months dragged on, the tension escalated until Connie finally reached a breaking point. In August of 1990, after a particularly violent incident where John had attacked her with a flashlight and ripped the hair from her head, she bravely filed for divorce and sought an order of protection. It was a desperate plea for freedom, but it was also the beginning of John's downward spiral into rage. And if you remember the date that I mentioned when John and Kathleen had met, this means that John and Kathleen had been seeing each other for almost a year before Connie finally filed for divorce. Despite the protective measures taken, the cycle of abuse was not easily broken. Shortly after John's arrest, unaware of his violent behavior, Kathleen had paid $600 to bail him out of jail, believing in the man he pretended to be. This pivotal decision would change the course of her entire life. Connie, wary and afraid, she chose to drop the order of protection and the charges against John. A decision that many have speculated was made out of fear of further retaliation. Connie bravely packs her belongings and she left with their two sons, basically disappearing from the narrative as if she's trying to erase the trauma of her life with John. After Connie left, John's dangerous tendencies only intensified, and Kathleen found herself unknowingly stepping into a violent situation. Prior to Connie leaving John, my family moved out of that neighborhood and bought a small home in the neighboring town called Spring Grove. This would mean that they had no idea that Kathleen existed, and years down the road would be shocked that Kathleen's body would be found behind their new home in Spring Grove. John and Kathleen had embarked on a whirlwind romance after John's divorce from his wife. Initially, Kathleen was swept up in the passion that surged between them, thrilled by the prospect of building a new life together. After 9 months of living in a small home together, they finally decided to purchase a bigger home together in May of 1991. It felt like a fresh start for both of them, a promise of stability that Kathleen hoped that would help John heal from his supposed past. Yet, just weeks after moving in, John's behavior began to shift. The erratic outbursts of anger that had once seemed infrequent now escalated, leaving Kathleen on the edge in the very home that was supposed to symbolize their new beginning. Feeling increasingly unsafe, Kathleen made the difficult decision to move back in with her parents. It was a painful step, yet she clung to the hope that distance would bring clarity. But after just 3 weeks apart, her longing for John and a sense of normalcy pulled her back into his orbit. Kathleen believed that love could conquer all and that with time, John would find peace. However, the 5 months that followed only deepened her fear as John's violence turned into something much more menacing. By November, she was terrified. She picked up the phone and called her friend, and her voice was trembling as she begged for her to help her move. This time, she felt certain that John's rage had crossed a line, and this time, he almost killed her. When Kathleen's friend arrived, she found Kathleen visibly shaken, red marks around her neck, which was a haunting testament to John's escalating aggression. Together, the two of them were gathering Kathleen's belongings quickly, each item a reminder of a life that she had hoped would be filled with love, but instead was marked by fear. As the two of them loaded the car, Kathleen felt a mix of relief and dread. She knew that this time would be much different than the last. Returning to her parents' house felt like reclaiming a piece of herself that she had lost. She was determined to sever the ties that bound her to him, telling her family and friends she was ready to move on. But her decision stirred a storm of anger in John. Almost 2 months had passed and the new year approached. On December 31st, Kathleen felt a flicker of excitement as she planned to celebrate with friends. After the darkness of her relationship with John, the thought of a carefree night in downtown Chicago felt like a long-awaited breath of fresh air. The group decided to embrace the spontaneity, landing at the Hard Rock Cafe. However, as they exited the cab, when they got there, Kathleen's heart sank. Standing at the entrance was John. His presence a chilling reminder of the control that he once held over her life. She had not told him of her plans, and that the realization sent a shiver down her spine that he had been following her. Ignoring him felt like a bold declaration of independence, but it was overshadowed by the knot of anxiety tightening in her stomach. Kathleen and her friends tried their hardest to shake off the unease, but the fun of the night felt tainted by John's looming figure. They all had a single drink, hoping to stay, but the weight of his gaze lingering in the back of their minds was just too much for them. They eventually decided to retreat to their hotel, seeking a safe space from the shadows that John casted over the evening. As they settled into the hotel room, Kathleen couldn't shake the feeling of being hunted. John's unpredictable nature had shattered the illusions of safety that she was finally clinging onto, and now, as midnight approached, she felt more vulnerable than ever. With each passing minute, the joy she had hoped to embrace seemed further away. She had vowed silently to herself that this night would mark the end of living in fear, no matter the cost. But soon, that would all be shattered. It was barely 2 weeks after John had followed Kathleen on New Year's Eve, but she was ready to move on. The holiday memories faded like the last echoes of the New Year's Eve fireworks, and the lively atmosphere of a local bar called Bogey's was calling her name. Surrounded by her girlfriends, Kathleen felt the familiar thrill of a night out. They laughed and shared stories, the chatter blending in with the pulsing music that filled the air. It was a chance to unwind, to embrace her new freedom, and to push away the remnants of her violent past with John. Just as Kathleen settled into the rhythm of the night, John made his appearance, uninvited yet again. He walked straight to Kathleen with his confidence radiating as if he owned the place. It was truly disgusting. Kathleen's heart raced, not from excitement, but from a twinge of anxiety. She had thought she had left him behind, but here he was, charmingly engaging her and her friends. With a few jokes and easy laughter, he managed to integrate himself into their circle, and soon enough, the drinks started flowing. John appeared generous, offering rounds that kept spirits high and glasses full. the atmosphere shifting under his influence. But as the night progressed, so did John's demeanor. What began as playful banter soon twisted into something much darker. On the dance floor, Kathleen and her friends spun in a carefree joy, but John's laughter turned sharper. His grip on Kathleen's wrist tightened in a way that felt possessive. A flash of anger crossed his face when one of her friends bumped into him, and suddenly the fun evaporated. The laughter died in Kathleen's throat as she realized the shift in John. John's playful demeanor changes quickly, and John leans in and he bites Kathleen in the face. And this was not a nibbling, flirty gesture. John violently bit Kathleen in the face until she began screaming. Kathleen's friend turns and rushes Kathleen into the bathroom, not knowing the extent of her injuries. As they entered the bathroom, her friend froze in fear with tears in her eyes as she sees the bites on Kathleen's face. John had bit Kathleen in the nose, the cheek, and the lip, and blood covered the bathroom floor. The atmosphere of bogeys quickly shifted as John was being forcibly removed by the bouncer. Kathleen and her friend exited the bathroom after cleaning the blood off of her and cleaning her injuries, and her heart began to race as she saw John's face twisted in anger. The bouncer's stern voice echoed in her ears, but it wasn't enough to stop the dread. Kathleen had hoped that this night would be a chance to escape her worries, but instead she watched as John lashed out in desperation, running outside the bar, slashing her tires, and cutting the convertible top of her Geo Tracker before disappearing into the night with all of the belongings that Kathleen had in her car. As panic filled Kathleen's friend, she called the police for help, but it was a little too late. The damage had already been done. As the two of them hurried to Kathleen's parents' house, dread settled heavily in the air. When the two of them walked through the front door of her parents' house, her father's face turned pale at the sight of his daughter's injuries. Fear gripped him as he rushed her to the emergency room, the adrenaline masking the shock that overtook him. Kathleen sat in the sterile waiting area, with her heart pounding as doctors examined her and started taking photos of all of the bite marks on her face. The sterile smell of antiseptic mixed with the beeping machines felt surreal. It was a stark contrast to the vibrant bar where her night had begun. Just as Kathleen tried to process what happened, the police arrived to take her statement, their presence a mix of reassurance, but also a lot of dread. They assured her that John would face consequences, and soon enough, he was arrested. With an order of protection in place, there was a glimmer of hope that she might be able to reclaim her life. Yet, not long after, Kathleen made a shocking decision to drop the charges and the protective order, leaving her friends and family bewildered. A lot of questions hung in the air as they struggled to understand her choice, but at the end of the day, they loved Kathleen and made the decision to support her. Kathleen had once thought that dropping the order of protection against John was a sign of strength and a way to move forward from the chaos of their past. But deep down, shadows lingered and she had a lot of doubt in her mind. And Kathleen would be correct. Not long after the incident at Bogey's, she went out with her girlfriends to another local bar called Frigates on a Friday night. The familiar thrill of the bar felt bittersweet. Laughter and music filled the air, but the weight of her choices weighed heavily on her mind. Did she make a mistake? As the night drew to a close, the girls walked outside to Kathleen's Geo Tracker, eager to head home. Yet, as they approached the car, a familiar silhouette caught their eye. A vehicle that looked eerily similar to John's parked nearby. Pushing aside her rising anxiety, Kathleen insisted it couldn't be him. She says, "There's no way that's John," though her heart raced with uncertainty. Her friends climbed into the car, and as they drove away from Frigates, Kathleen tried to shake off the feeling of being watched. But when the car began to follow them, the hairs on the back of her neck stood up. The girls exchanged nervous glances, and as the car drew closer, the flicker of the headlights illuminated a license plate that sent chills down Kathleen's spine. She reads the license plate with the letters FLFD, standing for Fox Lake Fire Department, where John just happened to be a current volunteer firefighter. Despite the undeniable truth, Kathleen fought against a sinking feeling in her stomach. She couldn't believe that he would follow her yet again. But as they reached the outskirts of town, the reality set in. The weight of her decisions began to press on her more heavily now than ever. The drive home was tense, each turn heightening her apprehension, and her friends whispering amongst themselves with worry on their faces. Kathleen parked the Geo Tracker in her parents' driveway, the night air thick with unspoken fears as they piled out of the car, hoping this would be the last time they saw John for a while. However, we have now learned that this is never the case with John. He somehow figures out where Kathleen and always manages to show up. A few weeks later, Kathleen is ready for another girls' night out at that local bar, Forgets. She is there enjoying the night until she turns around and she spots John inside the bar. Gathering courage, she walked up to him with her heart racing. She looks right into John's face and says, "You need to leave." But although she had the confidence on her face, the inside of her was just shriveling up. Their argument ended up spiraling and drawing a lot of glances from other patrons. Kathleen pleaded with him, urging him to stop stalking her. Her friends watched anxiously as tension crackled between the two of them. Finally, John stormed out, leaving behind a mix of relief and even more dread inside her. Kathleen's friend hoped that, once again, this would be the end of John, but we all know that's not the case. Just a few months later, in a twist that would haunt her forever, John managed to manipulate Kathleen into letting him back into her life. They found themselves in the driveway of their once shared home alongside their neighbor. Kathleen laughed lightly, telling the neighbor that despite the turbulent past between the two of them, they were attending couples therapy and things were starting to finally look up. She wanted to believe it herself. She wanted to believe in the possibility of healing and redemption. But on May 5th, 1992, that would all come to an end. On the evening of May 5th, the air inside Kathleen's parents' home was filled with the scent of a stew that her mom had cooked for them often. All of them sat down at the family dinner table where laughter was echoing around them. As they sat at the table, the clock on the wall ticked towards 6:30 p.m. when the shrill ring of the phone pierced the cozy atmosphere. Kathleen's mother, Betty, instinctively reached for the phone and her heart started to sink when she recognized the number. It was John, and a knot tightened in her stomach. She was hesitant, unsure of whether to let Kathleen speak to him, knowing the turmoil that he had caused their daughter. After standing there frozen for a few seconds, Betty decided to hand the phone to Kathleen, unaware of the gravity of the conversation. Kathleen took the phone out of Betty's hand with a calmness that surprised her mother, as fear was one that had once clouded her interactions with John. She spoke softly and without the distress that marked their previous exchanges. As the conversation unfolded, Kathleen's demeanor seemed almost at ease, and Betty watched curiously, wishing she could hear the words exchanged on the other end. When Kathleen hung up the phone, a serene smile crossed her face, and for a moment, it seemed as if she had found a fragile sense of closure. By 8:30 p.m., the dinner plates were cleared, and Kathleen stood by the front door with her jacket in her hand. She turned around to her mom and hugged her tightly and told her, "I will see you later," with confidence and a steady, reassuring tone. Betty felt by a flicker of unease, a mother's instinct whispering to her that something was not right. Yet, she pushed it aside, believing in her daughter's newfound strength. As Kathleen stepped out into the evening, her family had no inkling that this would be the very last time they would ever see their daughter alive. "At this time, it had now been over a year since my family moved from their old neighborhood in Ingleside where John and Connie also lived. And while the transition had been bittersweet, the new neighborhood in Spring Grove felt like a fresh start. My aunts had welcomed several babies into the family, filling the air with laughter and the sweet chaos of the little ones. On the night of May 5th, my grandmother was at home surrounded by the delightful energy of all of our grandkids, blissfully unaware of the unfolding horror just a few streets away. While my aunts enjoyed a much-needed evening out together, my grandmother was trying her best to calm one of my cousins, whose cries just seemed to pierce the peaceful atmosphere, meaning he needed his mother. As the hours wore on and the evening stretched into the night, my grandmother found herself increasingly frazzled. She had tried everything she could think of, snacks, toys, and even a gentle lullaby, but nothing seemed to soothe my cousin's restful cries. Realizing she had exhausted every single option, my grandmother reluctantly picked up the phone and called my aunt. She says to her, "He really needs his mom. I need you to come and pick him up." My aunt, enjoying a rare night out with her sisters, quickly agreed to return home and pick him up, completely unaware of the gravity of the situation that was about to unfold. My aunt drove across town as she navigated the familiar roads with her mind preoccupied with the thoughts of the little one waiting on her. As she entered my grandparents' neighborhood around 2 a.m., the tranquility of the moment felt surreal. She parked in the driveway and hurried inside to retrieve my cousin, who was already half asleep in his crib. After a quick hug and a gentle lift into his car seat, she breathed a sigh of relief, glad to be able to have her son back with her. As she pulled out of the driveway and headed to the hill to exit the neighborhood, a small SUV passed by. In the dim light, she caught a glimpse of the vehicle, a green Geo Tracker with a bald man in his 30s behind the wheel. Curiously, she noticed a young woman slumped against the passenger window, appearing to be asleep. The man waved at her as they drove past, and my aunt returned the gesture, a friendly instinct that seemed to bridge the distance between two strangers. What she didn't know as the SUV continued on its way was that the woman leaning against the window was not simply asleep. She was lifeless. A few hours later, at 6:45 a.m. on May 6, the sun peeked over the horizon in Spring Grove, casting a warm glow over the neighborhood. A man stepped outside his home on Rabine Drive, stretching his limbs as he breathed in the morning air. As he walked down his driveway, he noticed something unusual. A green Geo Tracker parked just beyond the railroad tracks, partially hidden by trees. This area is located 0.1 miles from the hill where John had passed my aunt in the car hours earlier. As he approached the Geo Tracker, a sense of unease settled in the pit of his stomach. The closer he got, the more he noticed the young woman slumped against the driver's side window. Her features obscured by the morning light. A chill ran down his spine as he realized the position of her body wasn't one of rest or slumber. Something was seriously wrong. The world around him faded as he processed the grim reality that the unknown female was not alive. Panic surged through him as his heart was racing as disbelief mingled with shock. He stood frozen for a minute, grappling with the scene before him, his mind struggling to comprehend the tragedy unfolding in such a familiar place. This was hitting too close to home. With adrenaline propelling him into action, the man turned and sprinted back towards his house, fear driving every single step that he took. He dashed inside with the door slamming behind him as he raced to the kitchen where his landline sat. His hands trembled as he tried to pick up the phone and quickly dial 911. When the operator on the other end answered, he said, "I needed to report a body," struggling to remain calm. The operator's voice was steady, but the gravity of his words hung heavy in the air. His thoughts raced quickly through his head as the image of the young woman seared into his mind. When the call about a body found in a Geo Tracker on Rabine Drive finally reached the paramedics, they quickly gathered their equipment with heavy hearts. Let me tell you about Spring Grove. It's a very quiet, close-knit community where the most serious incidences that they ever have are just minor fender benders or lost pets. As the paramedics navigated the familiar streets, an unsettling tension had filled the air, foreshadowing the grim discovery that was going to await them. When they arrive at the scene, they see Kathleen's Geo Tracker partially hidden behind the trees. As law enforcement arrived shortly thereafter, their faces mirrored the unease that gripped the paramedics. The officers moved swiftly, instinctively knowing that they had to secure the area. They unraveled bright yellow caution tape, creating a barrier around the Geo Tracker. Officers exchanged glances that conveyed a mixture of concern, but a lot of determination. They were all too well aware that the gravity of the situation would likely alter the Spring Grove community forever. Drawing closer to the vehicle, the officers took a deep breath, preparing themselves for the reality that waited for them inside the vehicle. As they peered into the driver's window, the horrifying scene unfolded before them. A young blonde woman sat slumped over wearing a DePaul sports team sweater. The woman was Kathleen. The sight sent a wave of sorrow through the officers. She was a victim of a violence that seemed unimaginable to happen in their small town of Spring Grove. Each detail, the way she was positioned, the stillness of her body, sent shivers down the spine of officers who were heavily seasoned in their career. The closer they looked, the chills grew as they opened the driver door to see that her brain was exposed on the side of her head due to blunt force trauma, possibly from a metal object. all of the teeth Kathleen had in her mouth were either knocked out or chipped and covered with blood. The roof of her car had blood splatter from the front to the back. The officer that opened up the driver's side door takes a deep breath and backs away from Kathleen's car door after he opens up her jacket and sees that her body was covered in bite marks. Kathleen's mother, Betty, was sitting in her living room that morning as she did every day when the phone began to ring. The voice on the other end belonged to someone from the local coroner's office, and the tone was somber, sending an immediate chill down her spine. The coroner says, "Is this Mrs. Tarowski?" And she says, "Yes, this is me. How can I help you?" He says to her, "I'm sorry to inform you that we found a body matching your daughter's description. It was discovered inside a vehicle registered to her name. We need you to come down to the coroner's office to identify the body." As the words sunk in Betty, her heart raced with a mix of disbelief and dread flooding her senses. Betty clutched the phone tightly, trying to process the news that felt more like a nightmare than reality. With trembling hands, Betty hung up the phone, the weight of the moment crashing over her like a wave. She glanced around the room, her eyes lingering on family photos that captured happier times and moments filled with laughter and love. Panic bubbled within her, but she knew she had to muster up the strength to face what lay ahead. Her mind raced with questions, each one more terrifying than the last. Inside the sterile confines of the coroner's office, a stark fluorescent light illuminated the stark reality of the situation. The body of Kathleen Tarowski lay on the autopsy table, a quiet testament to the violence that she had endured. As the coroner meticulously examined her remains, the atmosphere was heavy with the gravity. Kathleen had been a vibrant young woman, and now her life had been reduced to cold statistics. The autopsy revealed a haunting array of injuries. 14 abrasions to her skull, each a marker of the brutality that had silenced her laughter and her dreams ahead. 7 more abrasions marred her face, the result of a struggle that clearly had been both fierce and desperate. The coroner's hands moved quickly, documenting every detail with clinical precision. As he carefully examined the contents of Kathleen's stomach, a grim realization settled in. Kathleen had been killed just 4 hours after her last meal. Which means she was killed just 4 hours after leaving her parents' home on May 5th. Law enforcement eventually arrives at the home of John with a heavy sense of purpose, the weight of the day's grim discovery hanging over them like a storm cloud. They were all too familiar with John. His background as a former cop and a volunteer firefighter meant he had woven himself into the very fabric of the community. Yet their knowledge of John extended beyond more professional credentials. As we remember, John, months prior, had been arrested for attacking Kathleen, an incident that cast a long shadow of the tumultuous relationship that the community was well aware of. As they pulled into his driveway, the officers exchanged glances, knowing that they were stepping into a complex web of emotions and potential deceit. As they approached the front door, John answered. The initial shock on his face quickly morphed into concern as the lead officer informed him that Kathleen had been found deceased in her geo tracker and that she had been murdered. John's expression shifted, a flicker of something almost unreadable crossing his face. He acknowledged that Kathleen owned the vehicle, but his response took a suspicious turn as he awkwardly insisted that he had not seen her on the 3rd, 4th, or 5th of May. The way he delivered this information felt almost rehearsed, as if he were trying to distance himself from the very last few days of Kathleen's life. The police officers continued with their line of questioning, confronting John with the knowledge of his prior arrest for attacking Kathleen. To their frustration, John tries to play dumb, putting forth ignorance as if the past had no bearing on the present, which is astounding for John to think, but this is just who John is. They pressed him a little further, asking about his activities on the night of Kathleen's death. John quickly pivoted, claiming that he did actually call Kathleen at her parents' home around 6:30 p.m. on May 5th to study for an upcoming paramedic test, and he needed help. He stated that she had declined the offer, saying that she was too busy, a statement that sounded pretty rehearsed and honestly lacking in a lot of detail, which the police caught on to. But as he continued to speak, the officers were already well aware of the tension between the two of them, so he did not believe a single word that was coming out of John's mouth. To bolster his alibi, John then mentioned that he had called another female friend around 8:30 p.m., but she too had turned him down. Left with nothing else to do, he tried to claim that he went to bed early around 11:30 p.m. Yet, as the officers listened, their skepticism grew. They already had the information that contradicted this account, as John was a volunteer firefighter in Fox Lake, and there was a call for a house fire at 11 p.m. that night, one that he had failed to respond to. It was a striking devotion from his character that people knew him to be, because John had never missed a call before, and this discrepancy only deepened the suspicion surrounding him. The police officers also making note of the 4 to 6 inch abrasion on his neck and the cuts on all of his knuckles. As they wrapped up the questioning, the officers couldn't shake the feeling that they were dealing with someone who thought he could manipulate the situation to his advantage. John maintained his composure, but the cracks were beginning to show. While he believed he had successfully outsmarted them with his alibi, the reality was that they were meticulously cataloging every single detail, every inconsistency in his story. However, without enough concrete evidence to arrest him, they would have to tread carefully, but they were committed to piecing together the truth behind Kathleen's tragic death. Once the officers leave John's home, they begin discussing their next steps. They had a growing sense that this case was not as simple as it appeared to be. John's background, his previous aggression toward Kathleen, and the glaring inconsistencies in his alibi were all significant pieces of a puzzle they were determined to solve. As they started building a case against him, it became clear that they wouldn't rest until they uncovered the truth, regardless of how long it took. A month after the brutal murder of Kathleen, law enforcement finally brought John into custody, armed with a warrant that marked a pivotal turn in this investigation. He was taken from the local police station to the hospital, where officers sought to collect crucial samples of saliva, hair, and his fingerprints. The atmosphere in the hospital was charged, filled with tension as officers observed John's behavior. At first, he appeared calm, but as the process continued, his demeanor shifted drastically. He went from silent to having erratic outbursts and screaming incoherently. During one of his moments of heightened agitation, John fixed the officers with a penetrating gaze and blurted out, "Sure, I may have killed Kathleen, but you'll never be able to prove it." The chilling statement hung in the air, but the officers experienced in the ways of criminal psychology chose to dismiss it. They were confident in their growing case against him by the evidence that they had collected at the hospital. The DNA testing from his samples would soon provide a critical link between John and the horrific crime that shattered so many lives. Yet he seemed blissfully unaware of the impending storm that was headed right towards him. As John was detained at the hospital, a search warrant was underway at his home where investigators hoped to uncover more evidence. They combed through the living space, their eyes sharp for anything that would connect him to Kathleen's murder. Among the clutter and shadows, they discovered a fire poker lying inconspicuously next to the fireplace. It was a seemingly mundane item, yet the crime scene investigators knew it could hold the key to unraveling the case. Their suspicions heightened as they prepared to test the poker for blood, hoping that it might match the findings from the autopsy. Utilizing luminol, the investigators sprayed the fire poker, and when the black light illuminated it, the result was shocking. The poker lit up with a disturbing array of blood spatter, each dropping a grim reminder of the violence that had taken place in the home. The sight confirmed their worst fears. They had likely found the murder weapon. They quickly collected the fire poker along with pieces of carpet and other various items from John's home, sending everything off for further testing. The pieces of evidence began to accumulate, painting a picture that John had desperately tried to get rid of. Months passed as the investigation unfolded, with each day bringing more revelation. The pieces of evidence continued to be meticulously analyzed, and the detectives remained steadfast in their pursuit of justice for Kathleen. Meanwhile, John, still claiming his innocence, seemed to navigate through his days in a haze of denial, oblivious to the rope tightening around him. He believed that he outsmarted the system, all while he was unaware that the walls were closing in. Finally, on November 4th, 1992, the accumulation of their efforts resulted in a warrant for John's arrest, officially charging him with the murder of Kathleen Tarowski. The moment felt like both a victory and a solemn reminder of the life lost. As officers prepared to confront him with the charges, they steeled themselves for the confrontation that would finally bring justice to Kathleen's family and the community in Spring Grove. Some time had passed after John's arrest, and Betty and Bob Tarowski braced themselves for the emotional trial that laid ahead, with their hearts heavy over the loss of their daughter Kathleen. Finally, the day had come. They walk into the courtroom, and it was a tragic reminder of the events that had unfolded in their life. As the couple took their seats, they exchanged an understanding that this was not about just justice for Kathleen, but also about confronting the man who had stolen her future. Every day of the trial would require them to relive their worst nightmare, a painful journey through the evidence and testimonies that would reveal the depth of their daughter's suffering. The trial unfolded over weeks, marked by the back and forth arguments between the prosecution and the defense. Betty and Bob sat through harrowing testimonies, each recounting the violent relationship Kathleen had endured with John. The prosecution worked diligently to establish a strong case against him, showcasing the mountain of evidence that pointed towards his guilt. The DNA found at the crime scene, the murder weapon discovered in his home, and his troubling behavior in the days following of Kathleen's death. Meanwhile, John's defense team attempted to cast doubt on the evidence, presenting him as a misunderstood man trapped in an unfortunate circumstance. It was a brutal tug of war, with both sides passionately defending their strong narratives. As the trial reached its conclusion, Betty and Bob held their breath, the weight of uncertainty pressing down on them. When the verdict was finally read, guilty of murder, their emotions swelled to the surface. A life sentence in Illinois meant that John would pay for the crime that he had committed, but it did little to ease the pain of losing Kathleen. The couple clung to the small solace that justice had been served, even as they understood that the grief would forever be echoed into their lives. They left the courtroom hand in hand, determined to keep Kathleen's memory alive while grappling with the void they had left in her absence. Despite the passage of time, John's presence loomed over the Tarowski family. Over the last 30 years, John has filed numerous appeals, each time claiming his innocence, each time reopening wounds that barely had begun to heal for the family. Thankfully, over the years, the courts have consistently denied his request for release, a small victory for the family as they sought to honor their daughter's legacy. Yet, the knowledge that John was still alive, still breathing, was a constant reminder of the pain that he had inflicted. As of right now, John is still sitting out his life sentence in Illinois. But the other day, Kathleen crossed my mind, as that often happens when I cover these cases. I sat down at my desk at work to do a quick Google search on Kathleen's name, and I was absolutely shocked to find out that John right now is working with the Illinois Innocence Project, claiming that he has been wrongly convicted. When I saw this information, I quickly messaged Kathleen's second cousin, letting her know the new developments in this case. Everyone knows John's attempts to regain freedom could mean further torment for Kathleen's memory and potential threat to others. It is so sickening and very disheartening to know that an entire organization is currently backing John and advocating for his release after what he did to Kathleen. This was not just somebody being murdered. This was somebody being hunted down, stalked, and very gruesomely murdered by their partner. This is a very sickened individual who is being given free legal representation to get him out of prison. I want to make my mission clear that it is to protect other potential victims from the man who has already destroyed so many lives. As of last week, I have made several calls to the Illinois Innocence Project and will continue to update everyone as this continues on. John's presence behind bars is not just a matter of justice for Kathleen. It is a pledge to honor every victim of domestic violence. John needs to remain behind bars until he takes his last breath. I am asking each and every one of you to join me over at Inside the Case podcast discussion group on Facebook, or to follow me on Instagram at This Is Kenzie, K-E-N-Z-I underscore, as I will continue to release information as this new situation unfolds. This concludes the third episode of Inside the Case, where ordinary streets hide extraordinary stories.